Lecture 10, Book 5, Who is the Philosopher?
We saw in the last lecture that Glaucon is terribly puzzled, perhaps even outraged, at the notion of the philosopher king, the third wave that Socrates proposes. The next task facing Socrates, therefore, is to give Glaucon a full explanation of philosophy. And he begins by what you might almost call a personality sketch of the philosopher. Who is this person? What sort of human being is he or is she? The key to understanding this personality, again, as I suggested in the previous lecture, will be concerning this person's erotic makeup, if I can use that word. What this person loves, because philosophy is philosophia, love of wisdom. The philosopher is a certain kind of human being who has a certain kind of love. I think what Plato finally believes is that each of us can be characterized by what we love. We are what we love. And a philosopher loves wisdom. Socrates, in giving his exposition of who the philosopher is, begins at 474c and right away focuses on the question of love. He says, I quote, "When we say a man loves something, he must love all of it." Often you will see the gendered word man used. Sometimes that's true to the Greek, sometimes it's not. Remember always, however, that Plato is opening the doors to philosophy and to rule to both men and women. Socrates says the following as well, 475b. He makes an analogy between the lover of wisdom and the lover of wine. A wine lover, he says, loves all of wine. Similarly, a wisdom lover is, I quote, a desirer of wisdom, not of one part, but all of it. The person who eagerly approaches any form of learning, any form of wisdom, is to be counted as a lover of wisdom. Glaucon objects, and he has a very straightforward and very reasonable objection to make. He says to Socrates that this characterization of a philosopher is not specific enough. After all, lots and lots and lots of people love learning of different kinds. Glaucon and Socrates talk about people whom they call lovers of sights or lovers of hearing. That line is 475d. Think for a moment about who could be a lover of sights. By the way, I think the plural is very important, lover of sights, plural. Think of a tourist, a world traveler, someone who loves to travel and see new places, go to exotic countries, meet new kinds of people, discover cultures that he or she had never known about before. Isn't such a person to be counted as a lover of learning, a lover of wisdom? What about an archaeologist or an anthropologist who just, again, loves to discover facts about older cultures? Who then might be a lover of hearing? Somebody who loves to go to lectures. There are people who, for example, live in a university town and go to lectures of all kinds. The lecture could be on philosophy or history or science. They just love to absorb new information. Glaucon's point, in other words, is entirely well taken. Socrates' characterization of philosophy as the love of all of wisdom is not nearly specific enough. Socrates' response, and I'm going to quote directly from the text because this is a very important line, comes from 476b. He says the following, "The lovers of hearing and lovers of sight surely delight in beautiful sounds and colors and shapes, but their thought is unable to see and delight in the nature of beauty itself." The very last word is the key, itself. beauty itself. Lovers of sights, my example was of the world traveler. They love to accumulate information. They love to see many, many, many particular beautiful things. They have no interest in beauty itself. They, therefore, are not philosophers. And we'll explain why in just a couple of minutes. By contrast, a philosopher is, as Socrates puts it at 475e, a lover of the sight of truth. Analogous to a lover of sights, plural, this time it's singular, and the sight is not of particular beautiful objects, the sight is of the truth. Socrates says the following about the lover of the sight of truth, the philosopher, he or she, quote, believes that there is something beautiful itself and is able to catch sight both of it and of what participates in it, and doesn't believe that what participates is it itself, nor that it itself is what participates. 476d. That's a potentially confusing line. I suggest we concentrate on it and think about it pretty carefully, because in those couple of lines that I've read, what we are finding is a preliminary sketch of what scholars call Plato's theory of forms. Plato is as famous for the theory of forms as he is for anything else. In fact, the theory of forms is often used to organize Plato's career. Most scholars believe that Plato's work can be divided up into three periods: the early Plato, the middle Plato, and the late Plato. In the early stages of his career, Plato was very much in thrall to the historical Socrates, the actual man who lived 469 to 399. He wrote dialogues that imitate the historical Socrates. Again, this is the scholarly theory. By his middle stage, he had developed his own theory, the theory of forms, and perfected it or even went beyond it in his late stage. The Republic is the great work of Plato's middle period. It's the flowering of the theory of forms. In the lines I read just a while back, we got a sketch of it. And so let's think about it pretty carefully. First, let's start by thinking about the word for form. In your text, by the way, there'll be two English words, the English word form and the English word idea. They refer to two different Greek words. The word form translates the Greek word eidos, and the word idea translates the Greek word ideia. But those two Greek words, eidos and ideia, actually are almost synonyms. They really are synonyms, in the Republic at least. They are both derived from a verb which means to see. So I will use, as will most of your translators, the English word form and the English word idea synonymously. They both refer to the same thing. Now, I mentioned the etymology of the Greek words because it's the great clue as to what the word form means. The most literal way to translate eidos is look. And here I'm using look not as a verb, but as a noun. The look of a thing, the way a thing looks. If you read Homer, you'll see this Greek word eidos. He will be using it in a way to describe exactly what I've just said, the way somebody looks. If Menelaus, for example, the great king who we find in the Iliad and the Odyssey, is described as a great man and very handsome in his eidos, the way he looks. Now, this notion of the look of a thing is a pretty helpful clue when you try to figure out the philosophical meaning of the word eidos or form. Let me just exemplify this by pointing to a very common object. A chair. If you are sitting in a room and there are four or five pieces of furniture around a table, you don't have any trouble identifying what they are. They are all chairs. Well, how do you know they're chairs? They look like chairs. They have the same shape. Another word that comes very close to being synonymous with form. Now, imagine you are at a dining room table and there are six chairs around the table. The chairs could each be composed of different material. One is wood, one is plastic, one is metal. They might be different shapes, slightly. They might have a longer or a shorter back, etc. But the overall look of the thing is the same, and that's why they're counted as one and the same thing. Six individual chairs, one form, one look, chair. Go back to the quote that I suggested was so important at 476D. A form is a universal. The other way that Socrates regularly talks about forms is to use this pronoun itself, which I highlighted a minute ago. I'm going to reread 476D, or at least a part of it. The philosopher, the lover of the sight of truth, and this is the contrast with the lover of sights, believes that there is something beautiful itself. The philosopher has his or her eye on the form. And above all else, what the philosopher doesn't get confused about, and now I'm back in the quote, the philosopher doesn't believe that what participates in the form is the form, and doesn't believe that the form somehow participates in anything else. Let me explain what that means. The hard word, and probably the hardest single concept to understand in Plato's theory of forms, is the word participates. Let's use Socrates' example of beauty itself. He believes that beauty itself is a form. So all these phrases now are synonymous. Beauty itself, the idea of beauty, the form of beauty, these are universal. Now, there are many, many beautiful things in the world. A beautiful sunset, a beautiful painting, a beautiful face, a beautiful piece of music. All of those are particulars. They're very different from each other, but they have one feature in common, and of course that feature is they are all beautiful. Why are they all beautiful? Socrates' answer is because they participate, the key word, in the form of beauty. Another phrase you might use to illustrate what this notion of beauty itself means is absolute beauty. The philosopher is focused on beauty itself, or justice itself, or any of the other forms, and doesn't have very much interest in those particular exemplifications of the form. The philosopher is more interested in beauty itself than in the beautiful painting, more interested in beauty itself than in the beautiful sunset. It's the lover of sights, plural, who's interested in beautiful sunset, beautiful painting, beautiful X, Y, Z, not the philosopher. Let me give you two technical philosophical words that are widely used in English, both of which derive from the Greek. A form is ontologically and epistemologically prior to the particular. They are before the particular, they are superior to the particular. Let me explain these two words. Particular instances of the forms depend on the form. They get their being or their reality from the form. It's by participation that the beautiful painting becomes beautiful. The Greek word for being is to own. That's one of the ways Greek would express the phrase being. Ontological, therefore, means having to do with being or reality. So the reality of the painting, the beautiful painting, sunset, etc., depend for their reality, their being, on the form of beauty. This is a notion that is very hard for many people to accept because it suggests that beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty is absolute. Beauty is objective. Beauty is embodied in the form, not the particulars. The forms are epistemologically superior to the particulars as well. They are prior and superior. To know that a painting is beautiful requires me to be able to refer to the form of beauty in order to demonstrate that this painting is truly beautiful. The Greek word episteme means knowledge and is the root of our word epistemological. So in both these senses, ontological and epistemological, the forms are superior. Let me give you another angle or a way to think about Plato's theory of forms. I would suggest that Plato's theory of forms relies on a certain conception of language. Just reflect momentarily on the words we use when we speak. The most striking feature of them, whether they're nouns or adjectives, is that they have a general or universal reference. When I talk about the chair, I am talking about a concept that is beyond any individual chair. The word chair that I use doesn't refer only to this particular chair right here. No word in our language ever refers only to a single particular. All words have a universal, general meaning. Or to use examples that are from adjectives, go back to the standard example of this lecture, beautiful. I talk about the beautiful painting, but I'm not, when I use the word beautiful, referring only to the painting. I can use that very same word to refer to the beautiful sunset. So the word beautiful has, yet again, a very general meaning. Now, I would suggest that the inspiration of Plato's theory of forms is reflection on language. Plato believes, and many philosophers would agree with him, many philosophers would disagree with him, Plato believes that there are objects to which these words of ours refer. And as I've just mentioned, our words don't have a particular reference, they have a universal reference. So simply because we discuss beautiful things in the world suggests to Plato that there must be something to correspond to that word we use when we're discussing so many different things. There must be unity. That's a very basic philosophical impulse, at least in terms of Greek philosophy, and it's very, very sharp in Plato. Because I use adjectives to describe so many different objects, there must be a unifying principle. There must be a being which stands behind this word that I use. And that being is the form. Let me remind you of a character we met a pretty long time ago, Thrasymachus from Book 1 of the Republic. And I mention him because he was a sophist. And he, therefore, because he was a sophist, would radically disagree with what Socrates is saying. Thrasymachus would reject the theory of forms. And I thought it might be useful just to spend a couple of minutes discussing that, again, to give you an inkling of what this theory of forms really entails. Recall a word I used to describe the sophists in general, Thrasymachus in particular. He is a relativist. His definition of justice was justice is the advantage of the stronger. Now this is, as we discussed when we were talking about Book 1, a relativizing definition because it forces justice to be different in every single regime. So in a democracy, the stronger are the people, because the people vote in the leaders, the people choose their own leaders. In a democracy, what is just is what is advantageous to the people. In a tyranny, what is just would be what is advantageous to the tyrant. And these could be very different things. So in a tyranny, freedom of speech would be counted as a bad thing. In a democracy, freedom of speech would be counted as a good thing. That is the essence of Thrasymachus' relativism. What that suggests about sophists or relativists is that they simply reject the Platonic move to assert that there is a universal object, like beauty itself. To think about this in strictly linguistic terms, you might think of the sophist as really not liking that little pronoun itself. They don't like that word itself. There is no justice itself. There is no beauty itself, no goodness itself. Beauty for the sophists is in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty for Plato is not in the eyes of the beholder. It's in the form, in absolute beauty. If you and I are debating about two paintings in a museum, and I say the first painting is beautiful, and you say the first painting is ugly, and then you say the second painting is beautiful, and I disagree with you, according to Plato, at least theoretically, there's a right answer to the question. That's what it means to say beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. It's not simply a matter of taste. It's a matter of objective knowledge. Just as there is a right answer to the question, what is 2 plus 2? It equals 4. So too is there a right answer to the question, which painting is more beautiful? Answer, the one that's closer to the form of beauty, the idea of beauty. Now, I would like to make a very expansive claim at this stage of the lecture. I would suggest to you that this debate about language and the meaning of the general words that we always use in language, this debate about Plato's theory of forms is the essential debate in all of Western philosophy. I can't back this claim up in a short lecture because I can't cover the whole of Western philosophy. But it does seem to me that beginning with Aristotle, who was Plato's student, he studied in Plato's academy for 20 years, going through the medieval period, the modern period, the contemporary period, there has been one basic question that has never been completely resolved and has never gone away. And it is precisely the one that we are discussing here. What is the status of universals? Are there universals? Is there anything in this world that really exists that is like the idea of beauty? Or, more like Thrasymachus and the sophist, is there no such absolute, no such universal? Instead, there are only particulars. It seems to me that in the 20th century in particular, Thrasymachus' position was far more popular than Plato's. There were many, many philosophers in the 20th century who completely rejected any form of Platonism. Think of philosophers like Richard Rorty or Stanley Fish, or perhaps even the great Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. I would urge you to look at all these philosophers, and when you do, look at them with an eye to this particular question. It's a question that's sparked by reflections on the meaning of words. All of the philosophers I've mentioned, and Plato as well, begin with this question. What is language? What actually do words refer to? Language which we use every day and therefore which seems so ordinary and commonplace in our lives is actually quite mysterious. How is it that we can use these words, which are universal in their reference, and nonetheless only you interact with particulars? When I sit down at dinner, I sit down into a particular chair. Nowhere in my house will I find the form of the chair. Nonetheless, the word chair, as I've suggested, doesn't refer only to this particular chair. Of course it doesn't. It refers to every single chair in the world. The problem gets even more interesting when we come to words like beauty and goodness. Let me close this lecture by giving a quick summary of some of the really important points that we've discussed in the Republic. And I'm actually going to start with Book 2. What I would like to suggest to you is that the Republic has a beautiful structure to it. It has a momentum to it. And what we're finding out now that we're getting into Book 6 is that the dialogue is really picking up steam. We've broached the big issue of the theory of forms, and that's going to lead to even bigger issues very shortly. So let me just take a step back and remind you of how we got here. Let me begin in Book 2. Socrates says, for reasons that we've discussed, we must construct a city. Okay, so we do. That first city, the original city, is a city that meets only our most basic and minimal needs. Glaucon rejects that city. He says it's a city fit only for pigs. What we need in our city, says Glaucon, are relishes, luxuries, things human beings really want. And so Socrates moves forward. We move to a second city, which Socrates characterizes as feverish or luxurious. It's the city of expanding desires. It's the city where there's perfume and art and beautiful objects. The first city, if you reread it, you'll find out, doesn't even have furniture. The problem with expanding is that it will require the city to go to war. And the problem with war is that it requires us to identify a certain kind of citizen, a citizen who is well qualified to be a warrior. The main quality of the warrior is what Socrates calls spirit, aggressiveness, energy, the love of victory. I'm using the word love very deliberately. Socrates said something in Book 2 which is chilling. I highlighted it then, and I wish to highlight it again. Once war comes on the scene, he says, I don't know if war is good or bad. And I think we are now in a position to better understand that remark. Because there's war, there must be warriors. Because there are warriors, there must be people with very strong desires, people with spirit. What's the dilemma faced by the city when it has such people in it? These are potentially very dangerous people, these people with spirit, precisely because their desires are so strong. What's the solution? Politically, education. These people must be taught to subordinate their own desires to the well-being of the city. Instead of being disruptors, they need to be guardians. And hence, we begin the process of education. It starts in Book 2, and it's really picking up steam now. This was the point of my digression, to take us back to Book 2, is to put what we're now discussing into context. The presence of these highly spirited, or to shift my term, erotic people, people like Polymarchus, people like Glaucon, poses a grave dilemma, but it also gives us a tremendous opportunity, gives Socrates a tremendous opportunity. An opportunity to do what? To discuss philosophy, because it is the philosopher, as we have been discussing, who has a great love, a love of wisdom. And how is this love of wisdom expressed? It's expressed in this love of forms, of universals. This is the characteristic of the philosopher. So to return to the text that we had been discussing, remind yourself of the basic contrast. There are those people who are lovers of sights, of particulars. And then there are those people, And Socrates very much hopes that Glaucon, in particular, will be one of them, who love the universal. These are people who are able to redirect their eros, their love, their passions, away from the particulars towards the universal. And this will be the basic theme of the next couple of sections of Plato's Republic.